Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 303 featuring Al Quattrocchi, better known as Al Q, who has become a friend of mine through quarantine. I picked up fly fishing, as many of you guys know, because I talk about it on all the podcasts. But Al was basically my mentor and did a lot. I learned a lot from him over the summer. The cool thing about Al is that he's actually kind of in the industry as well. He is a graphic designer, and we talk a lot about his graphic design. He owns his own company. He's done some really amazing things. And we also talk a lot about the association of fly fishing and art and how it's actually... there's a lot of people who kind of go together in that area. And I've picked up everything from him, from learning how to cast, learning how to tie flies, learning how to do a bunch of things. And he's been a really great mentor, also a really great storyteller. Kristen, what do you think of Al?
Yeah, it was a good, really good podcast. Learned a lot about fly fishing. And I liked how he wrote a book, Corbina Diaries, which will be out by the time this podcast is out. You should buy that. He talked about, even from his graphic design to winning a Grammys and shaking Art Garfunkel's hand. I loved it. It was just a bright and cheery one. It's great for this time of the year,
too. Yeah. 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 It was really cool. I'm just going to say this, only in this podcast can you have the association between fly fishing and Jim Blin. So those of you who know who Jim Blin is, he's featured in this podcast as well. So, I mean, it's kind of cool. And honestly, you know, I know that this is a little bit of a selfish podcast about something that I've become passionate about fly fishing. And I think that's something that's become very important to me as an artist. I feel that there's a lot of art in fly fishing that I've learned. And I sort of wanted to put it out there as well. And I really want to thank Al for being such a great mentor to me and to all the other people. And the Corbina Diaries book is coming out, which, like you said, it's going to be really cool. And usually books about fishing are not super cool looking, but if you have a guy who runs his own graphic design company, it's going to be a work of art. I really am very excited about it. I can't wait to see it. And my son is featured in it as well. Yes. And we talk about that. So that's kind of cool. Yay. All right. It's coming up. This podcast, we're actually recording it just before Thanksgiving, and it'll come out right after Thanksgiving. But hopefully you guys have had a great Thanksgiving and a safe Thanksgiving. But a couple of announcements. What's going on, Kristen?
Yeah. So you can find all the events out at chaosgroup.com/events. And right now, we have one coming up on December 8th, and it's going to be a free webinar for V-Ray 5 for SketchUp. So want to check that out. It'll be really cool.
Perfect. Perfect. Mm-hmm. We'll have more announcements coming the next week. So be a lookout for that. Always go to chaosgroup.com for any other information about events or news. And a lot of our products obviously are being announced there as well, but can't announce all of them just yet. But next week we'll have some cool stuff to share with you guys. All right. What about the podcast, Kristen? Where can people find out more about the podcast?
So you can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And if you guys have any other ideas besides fly fishing topics to talk about on the podcast, you can always email us labs@chaosgroup.com. We're always welcome for suggestions as well as any feedback that you guys may have. And remember, these podcasts are also in video form, and Al and I were chatting in video form. If you want to see Al, he's a very charismatic person, like I said, and he's Italian, so he talks with his hands. So it's a lot of fun to watch the video. It's also available, like I said, on YouTube. So just go to Chaos Group TV and you can check out the podcast there, or on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast. All right. That being said, please enjoy this awesome podcast with Mr. Al Q.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has for now.
Well, cool, Al. I'm glad we're able to tell your story. We're going to tell, I have this theory. that what makes a great fisherman is how good they tell a story.
Okay.
And I've heard some of your podcasts in the past, and I know you tell great stories, and I want to sort of get to the root of that. And I know you grew up in New York. I moved out to California, and I've heard a lot about your fishing background, and I know you have a lot of art behind you as well and a lot of graphic design. And I want to start, I mean, obviously we are going to get to fishing because people have been joking about me talking about fishing on nearly every podcast that I do now. Did I tell you the story about the guys on the beach?
No.
I was walking in Malibu, or fishing in Malibu, right? And these two surfers walk by and they look at me and then they turn around and come back to me and they say, "Excuse me, are you Chris Nichols of CG Garage Podcast?" I said, "Yes."
No way.
And I said, "We always hear you talking about fly fishing on your podcast. So I figured it must be you because it kind of looks like you too."
That's hilarious. I got a crazy story for you.
Okay, go ahead.
It was the wintertime and I was with my buddy Jim Solomon and we were fishing. Yeah. We were fishing in Santa Monica and it was cold and we got down there early and there was a big sand berm behind us. So it kind of cushioned the sound a little bit because we were down by the water.
Yeah.
And we're fishing. All of a sudden I hear this like roar, like a crowd. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, "What the hell could this be? It's so early." So I climb up the berm and there was this sort of tunnel that came out of like Temescal Canyon that dumps out onto the beach.
Yeah.
There was a guy in a rabbit suit running, and this whole bunch of people, I guess it was a fraternity thing.
Yeah.
They were running after him like they were going to kill him. And this guy was running. It was like a Fellini movie. And it was like, I turned around. I said, only in LA. Yep. It was hilarious.
Very early in the morning, I'm sure.
Very early in the morning. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. That's cool. So Al, you have your own company, your own graphic design company, which is called
Tornado Creative.
Tornado Creative, and it's right around the corner from my office in Culver City.
Yeah, in the old Helms Bakery.
Yeah, yeah, building, which is great. Yeah, yeah, next to a father's office and all those things
right.
there, right? Yeah,
right.
Which is great. But how did that happen? I want to know about that journey. Because I know about your fishing journey, and we'll get to that. But how did that journey of an artist come from you? Where did that artist spark come from?
Well, I was always very creative as a kid. I loved to draw. And right. It was something that I did all the time. And I never thought it was going to be a career, but I just did it. It was my passion. Right. And when I lived in Brooklyn, we lived in a two-story house, two-family house. We lived upstairs, and we had another family downstairs. The family downstairs, the dad, his name was Angelo, a nice Italian family. He had five kids. And Angelo was an artist, but Angelo never pursued his art. He was a phenomenal artist. And he ended up having lots of different jobs, but he was really, really a great artist. And he kind of mentored me. And he said, "You know what? You need to follow your passion." He goes, "I never followed my passion. I never had the opportunity to follow my passion." And he goes, "You know, I had to work in all these different crazy things. I loved art so much, but I could never make a living out of it." He goes, "I see something in you, Al. You should really try to pursue it." So he kind of planted that seed in me. And it wasn't until high school, you know, I always was the guy who can draw in high school, and I was the guy who can draw in, you know, elementary school, but I wanted to go into marine biology. I wanted to go into oceanography. That was kind of my passion. So
right.
Everything kind of took a turn in Brooklyn when my family decided to move to California. And I was still a senior in high school and I was looking at colleges in Long Island to go for marine biology. To make a long story short, I ended up coming to California, going to LMU. And my dad was always in typesetting. He was an old hot metal print guy, you know, and he ended up getting a good job in California, and he was running a big typesetting place. So I would work there in the summers, you know, and make some extra money. And all the people that would come in were art directors. They were creatives, and they would bring in their comps and things and their art and stuff. And we would have to set the type. And I was like, "Wow, that looks like a really great job." I said, "How do these people do this?" You know? So my dad was nice enough to ask this young couple that was in Venice. And they said, "You know, my son is really interested. He's very artistic, and he wants to maybe get into commercial art, but he really doesn't know how to do it. Would you be willing to at least look at his portfolio?" So they said, absolutely. So they had me go over their place, and I put all my art down on the ground, and they said, okay, you know, you can draw pretty well. You need to learn commercial art. You need to go to a school. You need to get the trade. So I said, great. What do I do? And they said, well, we got to get you a portfolio. Let's work on your portfolio. So they kind of cleaned me up, got me a nice portfolio going, and I submitted it to Art Center in Pasadena.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And I got accepted, and I was like, wow. So, that was it. That was my path. I went to Art Center and went there for like 4 years. And so I started out in graphic design, and then I switched over to advertising design. I got to learn all the different disciplines. And I was, when I went to Art Center, it was humbling because, you know, you think you're good, but when you go to a school like that, you know, you're thrown into a pool of talent from around the world that's just way over your head. And I try to tell people, especially young people, it's okay to be over your head because that's how you get better. You know, I loved the fact that there were people that could kick my butt and they were just monster, you know, talented people because they raised my level, you know? And, so Art Center was a good experience. And then from there, I got a bunch of jobs around town. I was still working in typesetting. Yeah. This was around 1983 when computers really hadn't really hit yet. And, which is really interesting. I was able, my boss at the time who was doing typesetting was very, he could see the future and he realized typesetting was going to start to move away and computers were going to take over. So he knew I had an artistic background and I was doing typesetting. He goes, you know what I want to do? I want to start trying to figure out what computer systems we can buy so that I can get you into the advertising agencies and maybe we can rent them. We can lease them systems so that you can kind of work with them, do logos, do different things. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay. So he sends me to Silicon Valley and I literally, it was the Wild West. It was before before the Apple and everybody was buying different components and putting these systems together, you know, and they were really big, fairly big systems and they were really expensive. So we did Lightspeed, we did NPS, we had a couple of different systems that I thought were pretty good. And we ended up with Lightspeed. So he ended up getting a contract with them and he put me in all the different advertising agencies to show off these computers. So I can literally, and the art directors were scared crap. They look at me with this, like, what are you going to do? I said, you know what? Are you working on something? You want me to change the color? Give it to me. I'll scan it. We'll change it. Everything was 8-bit, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But like we were doing stuff quickly and they were like, oh my God, that's really cool. I said, this is just a tool to help you. You know what I mean? Don't think it's going to take your job over. So I was in the early ages of computer graphics, which is kind of cool.
Doing actual graphics, right? This
doing
is not,
graphics.
Which is different than doing, you know, CG or things or 3D work and stuff of that nature, right?
Yes. But what you would really appreciate was my last semester at Art Center. Uh-huh. They had the first computer graphic class ever. And I signed up for it and it was like 10 people. Okay. So we go to this class and what did we have for computers? We had Atari 700s.
Oh my God.
That were donated. Okay. So now we have these computers, right? And it was all DOS and you know, what the hell was that? Right. But the teachers we had were two guys from JPL. We had Jim Blinn, who was like,
No. Jim Blinn was your teacher?
Jim Blinn was my instructor, dude. Okay?
Are you serious?
No.
Because Blinn, he's a legend. The Blinn shader is like the bit. Yeah.
Okay. I had access to Jim Blinn. Okay. He was my guy.
Oh my gosh.
And I'll tell you how crazy it was, Chris. He would literally, you know, Jim was there and he had another gentleman that worked with him and they were doing all the imaging from Saturn at the time and coloring and stuff. He was like, cool shit.
I've met Jim.
Oh, yeah. So Jim would say, okay, guys, listen, we got these computers. Me and my buddy here can write anything. So don't worry about that. They're primitive. Tell us what you want to do. So do some drawing. So I would draw a penguin. And I would say, okay, I want my penguin to go from this end of the screen to that end of the screen. And Jim would say, okay, draw it out. Draw the different, you know, I want you to draw different stages. And then I would just hand him a disc. The next week he'd come back, he'd pop the disc in, and there goes my, you know, going back and forth. And we were learning from each other, right?
Right.
So that semester was rad because what we did on the Atari 700s, like blew Atari away. Atari was like, holy crap. He had no idea the stuff that was happening. Right.
Right.
And that was the beginning. And then Jim had a big party at the end of the class. He projected all the imagery from Saturn. We all hung out. It was such a great experience, but that's how I started.
That is amazing. That is amazing. Okay, so what year are we talking about now? Because I've got some history.
That was 1983 with Jim Blinn. Yeah, that was when I just before I graduated.
Oh, that's incredible. So, that is a great story. I tell you, I've had some quite some history of people on this podcast. I've had Doug Trumbull, who was like the visual effects supervisor for 2001. Wow. Wow. And I had Gary Yost on just a little not while ago. He's the first guy who wrote 3D Studio. So talking about Jim Blinn teaching your first class in computer graphics, that's
the first
awesome.
Computer graphic class ever at Art Center.
Art Center. That's really, really cool. Okay, so you're one of the first people to sort of touch a computer and figure out how to use it for computer graphics, right? Or for graphic design.
I was on the ground level. Right. Definitely. Yeah.
So Adobe, when Photoshop came out, that was sort of like an Illustrator. That must have been like, okay, this is how we're going to start doing graphic design, right?
But even before that, I was doing movie stuff, and we were using mainframe computers to do all the retouching, all the graphic stuff. And those were big end, high end, you know, really super
Silicon graphics machines and stuff like that, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's so I had that experience working as an art director with people that operated that stuff.
Okay.
And then from there, then Apple came in, and I learned, you know, obviously Photoshop and all the other programs. And we would do it ourselves.
Yeah. Right. And so some of the things, I mean, I remember you were telling me you got in, you were doing graphics for posters, for movie posters and stuff, and you were involved in that business for a long time, right?
Yeah. That was one of my first creative jobs. It was so funny. I because I had the opportunity to take computers all around the different agencies, there was a lot of movie studios that wanted that technology as well. And one of them was called, at the time, it was called Bacon Rhetoric. And they were in Burbank, and they did all the great posters. They used to work with Drew Struzan. Drew Struzan used to be there all the time. Okay. He was one of the great illustrators. Okay. Yeah. So I knew Drew. I mean, I met him and hung out with those guys. And I said, well, I really would love to work with these guys. So I went over there. I said, I would love to be able to, you know, get a job. And then and they said, well, we have a junior position open if you're interested. I said, absolutely. So I started working there, and I remember working on one of the projects, and I asked my boss, I said, would you mind if I work on some logos? And he goes, sure. I said, you know what? I'll do it on my own time after work. I'll just work on absolutely. So the next day I stayed that night and I covered all the walls with logos. Right. And when they, because I knew I had the talent, they didn't know that they didn't really know. So I went in a low position because I knew I could get myself, I finally worked myself up. Well, after doing that, they came in and they're like, holy crap, this guy can design. So they made me from a junior designer to an art director. And then I started designing movie posters from there. But that's kind of how my arc went up straight up.
Yeah. What was it like doing movie posters? I'm not really familiar with that. I must have been pretty challenging.
Well, in the beginning, it was really cool because we would shoot all the pieces with photography, and then we would cut up the photos, peel the emulsion off the back to get it really thin. And then spray mount them down and sand. And then actually we had some amazing retouchers that would actually blow the edges to clean them up. And then we would shoot film and then make the plates off the film.
You would airbrush the photo. I mean, literally airbrush.
I didn't airbrush it, but we had people that would do that. Yeah. So it was really an art form, you know, and everything was cutting things out and laying things and building this. It was like almost a collage piece of art, you know?
Right.
And then beautifully shot and, you know, backgrounds, you know, all that stuff done by airbrush, you know? So that's how we started. And then eventually went into Photoshop and then went into places where we would go to get things built, where they would scan in high res and then build it on these big systems. And, you know, I would do drawings and cut things together and build the comps, you know, get them crude, but get all the pieces there. And then we would scan everything high res and then go into, and I would sit in this beautiful studio and have them, you know, clean things up and blow things and make them all work. We need an area here for type and we need this and we need that and get the piece, you know, do the final art. And then we build the posters. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did that for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really good posters.
Yeah. I'm sure. And you did a lot of stuff in music as well, right? So you did.
Yeah. Started out in movie posters. And then, when I decided to go out on my own, one of the guys that I used to work with at the movie place was doing some music stuff. And so we joined forces. And then once we got on our own, we did a lot more music together.
Yeah.
And actually won a Grammy Award for music packaging in 1997, which was kind of cool.
Nice. Yeah. That's awesome. That's so cool. A Grammy Award. A Grammy Award for graphic design is kind of awesome to get that.
Yeah. It was great because it was in New York at the time, too. So we got to fly. I got to get my business partner. We got on a plane. We flew back to New York, which was my home territory.
Yeah.
And got to, you know, hang out with all my friends. And we just, it was just a great experience being in Radio City Music Hall. You know, from a little, when I was a little kid, my grandmother used to take me to go see the movies, the Christmas movies. And there I was on stage at you know, it was just, it was surreal, dude. It was just absolutely surreal. I got my Grammy Award in 1997 and they handed it to me, right? And then said, okay, go off backstage. The two people that actually greeted me.
Yeah.
There were three people.
Yeah.
Phil Ramone.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Art Garfunkel and I think it was Peter Green, who was the head of the Grammys at the time. I was like, this is like insane. They were all like, hey, congratulations. I'm like, I'm shaking Art Garfunkel's hand. So it was like, are you kidding me?
That's so cool. That's so cool.
It was fun.
But you've been on your own and you've been doing graphic design for a long time now. Obviously, you have your own company and you've been
Well over 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really, really awesome. And I've seen your work and you do a lot of great work, obviously, in a lot of places. And so we should talk about that. Now, I want to take a little detour back to Brooklyn.
Sure. Let's go back
and talk about fishing. Now, somehow, because you have two very, I mean, your fishing life, you're very successful as a graphic designer and you're very successful as a fisherman. And successful as a fisherman is a very interesting concept and idea. And that's really how you and I met, really, is my passion for fishing that I got into it. And I still remember very clearly, you know, I was sitting here learning to fly fish, obsessed, but like, I am going to learn this thing, but I'm hitting a brick wall with certain ideas. And I reached out on Facebook and someone said, you got to talk to Al Q. And then you and I reached out to each other and we became really, really good friends. And that's been really an amazing mentorship and has taught me how to get to fishing to the next level and my level of obsession. But
we got to get you on your casting next. We got to work on your casting.
I know my casting still needs a lot of work, but
we're going to get you.
My instincts are getting better.
Oh, they're great. They're great. I'm so impressed with you, Chris. In a short time, you've become a monster out there.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's because you know what? Because I do it all the time. I'm practicing, you know?
Yeah.
How do you get to Radio City Music Hall? Practice.
That's right.
You know, so I'm practicing all the time and that's a key thing and it's fun. And, you know, and this is something, you know, I want to get to with you as well. It's this whole COVID isolation thing has actually been a way for me to focus that attention on something. And that's the one thing that's been relieving a lot of the stress that's been going on in everyone's lives is to have something to focus on. And fishing has been that thing for me, which has been wonderful. But you were fishing. I remember hearing some of the stories as a young kid, like talking to the old guys by the, near Coney Island and you know, what's going on over there. So how did that bug for fishing really happen for you?
Well, I grew up in Sheepshead Bay and to put that in context, Sheepshead Bay was South Brooklyn. And at one time, Sheepshead Bay was the largest commercial fishing fleet in the world. Okay. They had over 40 boats that would go out every day. Where you can go fishing, okay? Whether it was inshore on wrecks or offshore, or whatever. It was an incredible busy port, and every pier was bustling. In fact, back in the day, Babe Ruth used to take the train, get off into Sheepshead Bay, and go fishing in Sheepshead Bay. It had a lot of history there. So I grew up. I went to Sheepshead Bay High School. That was where I grew up. So I was around the water. You know, when I would go home, I would hear the boats come in. I'd hear the horn sound. Sometimes I'd get on the bus and shoot down to the bay and buy fish off the pier, and my grandmother would cook for me. So that it was in me. Okay. It was always in me. What really set me to another level was my parents. You know, we lived in Brooklyn, but my parents wanted to have a little summer place. And my mom and her girlfriend, they kind of talked our dads into buying a little summer place in Breezy Point. And Breezy Point was in Queens. It was only about 13 miles from where we lived, but it was right across Jamaica Bay and it was on its own little like island peninsula. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the tip of Sheepshead Bay, there was a jetty, very famous jetty, and everything, all the boats that would go down the Narrows into Manhattan had to go around this jetty. So if you imagine Montauk being the end, the east end of Long Island,
yes,
the west end of Long Island, the point would be where I was.
Okay.
So they got this cool little summer house there. And I was like a pig in in crap. I mean, I couldn't believe, like, I had the ocean on one side, because our little bungalow was right on the ocean. We had an ocean on one side, and I could walk less than half a mile, and then I was on the bay. So I could fish the bay, I could fish the ocean, I could walk down the beach, fish the jetty, and it was a phenomenal fishery. Okay, all surf casting, no fly fishing for me then.
Right.
All plugs and everything else. So because there was no internet, and because, you know, I was a young teenager thrown into this mecca of fishing, the first thing I did was run down to the beach and see all these old timers and just try to pick their brains. And, you know, they knew I was a maniac. They saw me out there every day. So eventually they'd give you a little tidbit every now and then. And eventually they brought you under your wing. And I was very fortunate that the old timers liked me and showed me the places to fish and called me up when the things were going on and got me involved in it. And I told myself, I really told myself at that point, I said, this is a sport that I'm going to be in for the rest of my life. Cause these guys were all older. Some guys had pacemakers and they were throwing plugs and catching stripers. I'm like, I want to do this the rest of my life, you know? And, so that's kind of where the passion really blew up was as a young teenager in an amazing place. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it wasn't dissimilar. You know, I grew up in Greece, believe it or not, and we used to go to the Greek islands in the summer.
Wow.
And so I had literally a cane pole that I threw with a little bobber and try to hook a little snail on the end of it and catching these little fish. But that's all I was doing. But I remember my dad, and this is the thing, and it still exists, Al. It's like my dad told me the story about when he used to go fishing as a teenager in the 50s in Bermuda, and he caught bonefish there. And he told me this legendary bonefish, and to me, it was still this legendary fish, which I still have not landed a bone. I've caught one, but I never landed it. And then I was like, this whole passion for me has started because of me hearing this legendary bonefish story that's in the back of my head. And I've always still pursued it. And, you know, and then I fished in Texas when I was in grad school. And then now I just started fishing again now, but now I'm like obviously doing it, you know, once or twice a week. But that's really what started it for me, is like remembering that story. And it's a story of like this fish that you're going to catch, you know? And we'll get to because that corbina to me now is like my bonefish. Well,
when I was little, you know, and I couldn't afford to go out on the party boats. So the party boats would leave and the piers would be empty and there'd be nobody around. We would climb down the piers and it was always herring, you know, or Manhattan. So when the herring were in season, I would buy a can of Puss in Boots cat food, seafood flavor. Uh-huh. And I'd get a couple of treble hooks with a little weight at the bottom, and we'd throw it in the water and just snag. I'd snag herring and fill up a bucket, you know, and then I'd sell the bucket of herring to the party boats for like $5. So I was like, you know, I was wheeling and dealing. The other thing I would do too is in the summer times, we would dig up our own sandworms, and then we would go to the bridges. And we'd go up the bridges, bring a big piece of cardboard to block the wind, because sometimes it get windy up there. Yeah. And we would fish the sandworms off the down high on the extension bridges, down off the pilings, and catch stripers, like catch, you know, schoolies, and just, you know, clean up on them. It was great.
Wow.
So I was fishing anyway. Yeah. I didn't have a lot of mentors, but we tried to figure it all out, you know, on our own. So it was fun.
Well, when you started moving to fly fishing, and when did that start for you?
Well, I had read about it in New York when I was a kid. I used to subscribe to Saltwater Sportsman. That was my Bible. And I used to read all these stories about Lefty and Charles Waterman and all these guys using fly rods, Milt Roscoe and all these guys. And I said to myself, I got to learn to do this. But I didn't have any mentors at the time. I was still a young kid. And there was articles that this guy, Nick Curcione, used to write. And he was in California. Okay. And he was Italian. I'd always read his articles. He was catching bonita in the harbor and fishing off the surf. And make a long story short, when we came to California and we landed in Playa del Rey, LMU was the closest school. So that's where I went to college.
Right.
And there was a professor that was teaching criminology and deviant behavior. And it was Dr. Nick Curcione,
right?
The same guy that I was writing. That was writing the article. How talk about serendipity.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And I said, there's no way it's the same dude. And they go, no, that guy's really hardcore into fly fishing and stuff. I said, no way. So at one of the alumni barbecues, we connected and Nick was my mentor.
Right.
And taking me to the beach and showing me what I needed to do back in the day to catch fish.
That's awesome.
That was my journey.
But the thing that's interesting to me, because I always hear this now, especially that I'm just doing fly fishing, and I see, you know, I follow people on Facebook that do both. The fly fishermen, there's a little bit, the mentality is a little bit different about it. And there's a little bit more finesse and art and passion and obsession that I think an artist's brain tends to gravitate towards a little more. So what do you think the connection is between fly fishing and the sensibility of fly fishing and creativity in some way? There's got to be something that follows that.
I think it's all the details that are involved in fly fishing. There's so many. It could be fly fishing could be as complicated as you want to make it. Yeah. And it could be simple. I tend to try to keep it simple. But being a creative person, it encompasses everything. I could actually sit down and create something on a vise, and then I could cast it and catch a fish on it. And it's very, very rewarding to me. But you're right, Chris. You see a lot of dentists, a lot of surgeons, they're all into fly fishing. And I think it's people that use their hands, people that noodle around and are really perfectionistic. They all gravitate to fly fishing. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's, fly fishing has this mystique that's a little bit snooty. You know, it used to be like, you had to be the top, fisherman to be a fly fisherman. But I never looked at it that way. I looked at it always that fly fishing was a way for me to stay in the ocean. I didn't learn to fly fish to catch trout. I was always a saltwater guy. So I wanted to get a rod and run to the beach. And it was just another tool for me to have that experience. And basically, if you want to really break it down, it's a glorified hand line.
Right.
Fly fishing. It really is. You're casting, but then you're doing everything with your hand. And there's something really visceral when you get that tug with the feel and feeling the fish in your hand.
Right.
That goes right into your DNA. I mean, that's like, it doesn't get any better than that. So,
I was thinking about that with that bat ray that I caught this, this weekend, right? That is a direct line to the bat ray. There's no weight between that.
No.
So I feel every single flip and flop and interest, you know, like I felt the life of that fish at the end of that line, you know?
Yes.
And I gave it to fish. The fish went back in the water and was perfectly safe, but it's a much more direct connection because there is nothing between the line and that fish except the hook. And that's it.
And what I love about the surf more than anything is any cast can produce something spectacular. It could be a 2-inch perch, or it could be a 30-pound striper. It could be, you never know. You know, when you're fishing in a stream, you pretty much know what you're going to get.
You're going to get a trout.
You're going to get a trout. And that's great. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's a lot of fun. I love people that fish for trout. Fantastic. Great thing to do. But you kind of know what you're going to get. You know, at the top of the, you might get, a trout that's this big, but you're going to catch fish. The ocean, you could hook a monster. And you just don't know. And that, to me, that whole allure of, and that's what really fishing is all about, hope. It's all about you cast your line and you hope there's something at the end, right? and with the ocean, it's like Jules Verne. You don't know what's going to eat your fly, right? Yeah. So that whole thing just charges me up. It gets me really excited.
I think when I first started, because I used to fish a lot. And when I first started fly fishing in the surf, and I was like, this is so hard. It was the hardest thing I
ever. It is.
Because, I have no control of this line. The waves are we're on the Pacific Ocean, on the west coast of the Pacific Ocean. The waves are bashing down on us.
Right.
I don't know, that wave's going to come hit me by accident. I don't know how to deal with this. I don't know if I have the right line. I don't know have the right equipment. My equipment is, going to get bashed and gridded. It was really hard. It was like basically saying,
difficult.
I want to learn how to play music, and I'm going to start with a French horn. It's like
you're absolutely right. It's the hardest way to fly fish. And that's why when I teach people how to fly fish in the surf, I don't even put them in the surf until I get them casting and showing them how to do a Belgium cast to keep the line away from you and get all that stuff, that crazy stuff that you got to know. Dealing with a sinking line where gravity wants to take it down, there's a lot of moving parts. Once you get that figured out, then you move into the surf, and then it's a ballet. Then you got to understand, like you said, the way the rhythm of the ocean and putting it together and watching your backcast, because there's people on urban beaches. There's so many obstacles. Yep. So you're absolutely right. It's the most difficult way to fly fish. Period. Is off the beach.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. And I think,
and it's the most rewarding.
It is. It is very rewarding. So the moment I started to realize, you know, when I needed your help specifically, the moment that happened was when I started to realize I just started to catch like a couple of perch. And I had almost been fishing for almost 6 months, and I still was going out every other weekend and not catching anything, but I'm like, I'm sticking to it.
You're
and
amazing.
I started to catch some perch, and I was like, okay, I'm getting some success here, and I'm starting to understand. I know all the mistakes I was making now that I've done it a few times, but I started to get it. And then I started to see this fish that everyone started talking about on the beach, like, and it's this thing that comes on the beach, and it's something that surprises you. And I remember that quote from your book, which we're going to get into. It was from Jimmy Kimmel talking about the corbina that people don't even realize are underneath their feet as they're at the beach. Yeah. And that is an incredible fish to catch. So that is a fish that I think is very interesting, that led you to do a very cool creative project to deal with your with the situation that you were dealing with in COVID and had to get that part out. But tell us your history and your passion for this fish and how that led to you creating the book that you made.
Okay. Well, the first corbina I ever caught was, I think, in early 1992, maybe. And I was with Nick Curcione, and we were fishing off of Hermosa Beach. It was the wintertime. We were fishing for perch. And at the time, it was before all these really cool fly lines came out. You know, now you have these lines that are integrated, which means from the shooting head to the running line, it's a clear, smooth transition.
Right.
Back then, we had to make our own shooting head. So we had to use lead core line, which is really heavy. And then we'd have to loop them to, I think we used to use a running line, amnesia running line, which is just a really heavy mono line. Okay.
Okay.
And it would clank through your guides that it would come out. But that all derived from Northern California. And in Northern California, right, those guys invented these shooting head systems because they were throwing long lines to salmon in the rivers.
Right.
Okay. So that's kind of where it developed. Then it came down to California, Nick and a few other guys were starting to implement these systems. So I was using this type of line, and it was very, very difficult to cast.
Right.
And it would land like a hand grenade because it was so heavy.
Right.
But in the winter, and you're fishing troughs, deep water, even though I never saw the corbina, but they were in there, and I ended up hooking one for the first time. So when I caught my first corbina, Nick goes, dude, you don't know how amazing this is. You caught a corbina on the fly. Like, you can count the amount of corbina on one hand in your lifetime. This is a very, very difficult fish to catch. And he was right, given the equipment that we had. Okay.
Right.
Then as things started to change about 10 years later, there was a whole bunch of young guys out on the beach surf fishing. I got involved with them, and the corbina were there every year. And now we had lighter lines. Mm-hmm. And the problem was we were tying these flies that looked like sand crabs, and we were using epoxy. So we were casting these flies, and it was like throwing a pebble into shallow water. It was spooked the hell out of the corbina. So we would catch them occasionally, but there was no rhyme or reason. There was no rhythm. There was nothing. Every time I caught a corbina, I would keep the fly like a wounded warrior and say, okay, that's the fly. And then I would go out again and wouldn't catch one again.
But these, just so people know, because not everyone knows about it, the corbina is like super shallow water, super shallow, right?
They're a croaker. They're in the croaker family. They have a little barbel, and they come in the early summer. And I think they time their spawning period. We don't really know this for sure, but I think that's kind of in the spawning period. They time it at the same time the sand crabs show up on the beach in numbers, because they feed primarily on those sand crabs. Mm-hmm. And that's the time when you'll actually see these fish come in shallow water and literally do headstands in just inches of water. So the problem for us was to try to crack the code. How could we get these fish to eat these flies and not spook them? And one of the things my buddy Paul Cronin came out with was this surfing merkin. It was a crab pattern that this guy Del Brown was using for permit in Florida. And so we tied them, we tied them very light. We tied them so that they would land soft. You know, we didn't use super heavy eyes. And we started catching more and more corbina. Like in one season, Paul caught, I think, almost 27 or 30 corbina. Mm-hmm. And that that was like an eye opener. That was a game changer. And that was when I finally said to myself, okay, this code is cracked, because we're all catching multiple fish each season. Mm-hmm. And so I started writing about it and talking about it. And it didn't take till 10 years later to people really starting to catch on to it, because they're really difficult fish to catch. Yeah. Even though you know everything, it's still, they're still hard to catch. You got to position yourself right. You got to understand the tides. There's a whole thing about it, but it's very, very rewarding. Even if you get one or two a season, it's still a very rewarding fish to catch.
I've gotten eight this season, so that's pretty good.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of the, you know.
So you've been writing this story down for a while. You've been doing this. And then suddenly, like, you know what? Now I'm sitting at home. It's time for me to start making a book about this, right?
Right. I've been threatening to do a book for over 10 years. I've even tried to collaborate with people to do a book on Corbina, because there's nothing been written about them. And it was like herding cats. Mm-hmm. So there's always a positive sometimes out of a negative. And obviously we're in a lockdown, we're in a bad situation today. So I had all this over 20 years of information sitting in my computer, photography, all sorts of articles, presentations, right, everything. And I said to myself, you know what? I'm home now with COVID. I have my whole computer system here at home, because I used to go to work and then come home. I didn't, you know, have a computer at home. It's all at my fingertips. I'm going to work at nights. I'm going to write an outline, and I'm going to start to put this thing together. And in about three months of my time, I had a book. And some of the best photos, Chris, came from this year at one of your hotspots that you took me to. And I'll tell you, in 1 hour, on one great day there, I got probably close to 10 of the best photos I've ever taken this year. So it all came together.
I remember that day, just so people know, there's a hotspot that I have that we're still keeping secret, that we found some really great Corbina there, and you were excited about it. And I said, well, I'm going to bring my son here because he wants to fish. And you said, I'm going to come, but I'm not bringing a rod. I'm bringing a camera, and I want to take some pictures. And you took, because you needed pictures for your book. And it was such a good spot, because you knew there were going to be Corbina there that you can take pictures of.
And we had good sunlight that day.
We had good sunlight and everything. Yeah. It was such a great day. And I remember you going there and you being very adamant about taking pictures. And I think you even told me a story that one previous summer, you took the whole summer off fishing just to take photographs instead, right?
Well, you know what I did? I tried to give myself tried to be very disciplined. And I said, this season, I'm not going to pick up a rod. I'm just going to take my camera. And I want to learn. I want to watch. Because if I want to watch these fish, I want to try to get good positions in these fish. And I want to, you know, just learn. And I learned more about Corbina that season than I ever did fishing for them, just by being patient and watching them and taking good photos. A lot of the guys that I used to fish with, they were all with me on the beach. And anytime they see me crouch down, they'd come running over and their cast would go flying over my head, because they knew I was like a point. I was like a dog. I was exactly where they were, and they would fish for them. So funny.
That's funny. That's really funny. But I remember that day, because Brady wanted to go fishing, and he was being very, you know, passionate. He obviously doesn't want to fly fish. He thinks it's a little too complicated. But you told me, it's like, here's how Brady should fish. And we gave him, you know, a traditional rigged Carolina rig for him to fish with. And he caught, you were right there when that happened, fairly large Corbina.
It was a great fish. It was a great fish. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's still like, that was one of the most amazing experiences in his life, was catching.
It was just as amazing for me to experience him doing it as him actually doing it. I got just as much charge out of it than Brady did. It was so great.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because he just, that fish just took off, and his rod was bent over like really hard, and he just didn't know how to handle it. And he's like, just calm down, Richie.
Yeah,
because that's an experience.
Lift up and reel down and take a deep breath. And he landed that like a champ.
Yeah, yeah. Because that was, I can know the adrenaline that gets, because that fish can hit and go fast too.
Yeah.
They're pretty fast. Really, really cool. Really great experience for that. But so you now have your book is completed, and it's going to come out early December. Is that when the date's coming out?
Probably the end of November. They should be here. They're on a slow boat from China right now. They should be here. They say they're telling me November 18th is supposed to be here.
That's awesome. That's pretty awesome. And I know you're going to be doing some book signings at Fisherman's Spot and things of that nature, which is really cool. There's a lot of great great stuff. The thing that I always found really interesting about what you do is how you get involved in the community in a lot of ways and how you get people interested in things. You do a lot of things, you know, the graphics you do bring awareness to certain things. You do a lot of stuff for I know like the fly fishing group on Facebook, you did their logo for them. You did a bunch of things. How do you feel that fishing and graphic design and all the things you do help the community and get information and get a lot of things out? How do you feel about that part of your experience?
Well, part of my mantra of why I fish, and one of the things is I want to educate people and I want people to learn as much as they can. And the stuff that was handed to me by the old generation when I was a kid really stuck with me. And I said, this is something that I want to pass information forward. You know, I want to help the younger generation, you know.
Right.
So that's always been something that's been part of me. And the way I did it was try to create events and try to create fun ways to fly fish to get the community involved. So like I think it was 2002 when I started the One Surf Fly event, which was a great event, and there was nothing like it in California. It was a time when nobody was doing anything, even the shops weren't doing stuff. And I said to myself, you know what? It just takes one person. So me and a bunch of people got together, and we decided to do this One Surf Fly, and it was just a fun event. I had a little bit of a name in the industry, so a lot of people would give me great prizes for raffles. We would pick a nonprofit depending on where we were up and down the coast.
Yep.
Everybody would show up at the beach. You brought one fly. So you could tie whatever fly you want, brought one fly. We'd all get together. We would put the fly in an envelope and we put your name on it. So let's say, Chris, you had a beach bug. And I would say, okay, number three, Chris, beach bug in the bag. Before we started, everybody picks a fly. So if I picked your fly, Chris, okay, I get to fish your fly for the whole day. If I lose your fly, I'm out. So the three ways you can score: first fish, the most fish, and the biggest fish. I had spotters on the beach that were just for One Surf Fly spotters. They had a badge, they had a card. Everybody had a card around, a laminated card. And you caught a fish, you raised your hand, they'd run down, they record it, measure it, write it on your card. Okay.
Right.
And then the best thing is, let's say make believe you caught the first fish. Okay. You're going to get a prize. You're going to get a prize at the end of the thing. Whatever fly you use to catch that fish, that person who submitted the fly is going to get a prize too. So everybody was involved. It basically leveled the ground. So if you were a 13-year-old kid that didn't have a lot of experience and you drew a beach bug, and then somebody who was 27 that was a great fly fisherman drew a pink clouser, the kid with the beach bug might outfish him. So it was like it was just an even thing. Brought the community down. We had over 60 people at some of these events. Okay, so I started that. That was great. Then we did the double haul ball to teach people. It was a free day of fly fishing with seminars and stuff. We did the carp throwdown. I did the Joe Brooks movie. Did you come to that last year? The Joe Brooks movie I did.
No.
It was a movie about Joe Brooks, who was the father of modern fly fishing. We did at the Patagonia store. We had Traeger and all these, all to raise money for Cast Hope and for the Joe Brooks Foundation. So every place I did the One Surf Fly, whether it was for breast cancer or whether it was for Heal the Bay or whether it was for the Mahelia Coalition for breaking the dams down, the Gimbering Steelhead, it all tried to support the resource. And that's what turns me on, is to do things for the community like that. That's what I've been about.
Yeah, it's really great. You're very, very generous with your knowledge and your ability to share with the community. I think that's a very honorable thing. I just, you know, there's something about the way that, to me, I've always thought about fishing as something that is not to be. You don't wait till retirement to go fishing. You know what I mean? I think a lot of people are waiting till retirement to enjoy fishing. I think it's a kind of a waste a little bit to do that. And I think that if that's something that you're passionate about, and it doesn't have to be about fishing, it could be about something else. But if you're really passionate about something and finding that connection. And I think what also is interesting to me is that your ability to find that connection between the thing that you love, in terms of fishing, and the things that you're good at, which is graphic design, and try to make a blend between those two things so you can help both of those. How do you manage that?
It's natural. I mean, I'm a creative person. I try to make beautiful things. And if I can incorporate that into my fishing, by branding things and just keep making fun events and making them look cool and stuff like that, that's like a win-win for me. I get to do the two things I love together.
That's awesome. Well, this is what kind of stuff do you I mean, obviously we heard a little bit about, I wanted to get into the fishing stuff, but I do want to go back to Tornado Creative and find out more about your company and what kind of stuff do you guys do and where people can look at some of the work that you guys are doing.
Yeah, you can go to tornadocreative.com. We're located in Culver City. That's our main offices. Now because of COVID, we're both working at home, but you'll see the breadth of our work is there. And we do lots of stuff, man. We've published books. We do exhibition graphics. We brand. We do a lot of branding for companies, big and small. We've done a lot of music stuff, a lot of movie stuff, a lot of corporate stuff. It's all over the place. But we try to do great work, and we're only as good as our last project. I just did a restaurant. We do a lot of art stuff, projects with art exhibitions and things.
There's a really, really cool. I mean, people should follow your Instagram, which is also quite beautiful, because you do some beautiful photographs on your Instagram, which is also, I noticed, you have also a big passion for food on your Instagram as well.
Yeah, I do. I'm Sicilian. I'm full Sicilian. Grandma and grandpa on both sides were from Italy, came across on a boat, and didn't have a lot of money, growing up. We were just, middle class, lower middle class people. But one thing about my grandparents that I'll truly say is that they always put food on the table and they always cooked what was in season. And so we celebrated whatever the vegetable that was in season. And now it's like, you watch the Food Channel, everybody's doing that. But we were doing that, 50 years ago. And so I got to see my grandmother and my grandfather cook all the time. And I used to go and visit them and try to write down what they were doing because they never measured anything. And they were great. They were the best cooks ever. I mean, I've never been to a restaurant that's better than what my grandmother and my grandfather cooked. So I was very fortunate to be around good food my whole life.
Right. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, people should definitely follow your Instagram because it is very appetizing. And it's also really cool to see a lot of the cool stuff in the fish that you're catching. And I am very, very grateful that I, this summer, not only did I really pick up fly fishing, but it was because of people like you that took me under your wing and say, I'm going to help you. I'm going to get you to the next level and do that thing. And I'm doing it. I'm doing a lot of it. I'm learning and I'm tying flies. I never thought of myself
That's as great.
Someone who would be tying flies, but the first, I think it was pretty much the beginning of our, shelter in place is my wife got me a fly tying kit. And I just said, I'm going to start. I'm going to learn. And now I have drawers full of feathers and
I know. It gets overwhelming. It gets really overwhelming. I think you've seen my tackle at Temple. It's out of control.
Yeah. Your back office has got a lot of different things in it. But I went to the fisherman's spot and I talked to the guys. I wanted to get some hackle feathers, some grizzly feathers. And they said, this big package here is like a grab bag of stuff. And it was this huge thing. And it was like only $20. It's like, I can do a lot with this.
Yeah, there you go.
So yeah,
it's like a moth to the light.
I know. It's like, yeah, it's dangerous. It is dangerous because fly fishing can get expensive if you get a little too carried away with it. But it's pretty fun otherwise.
Good thing to do is go to Michael's craft stores.
Yeah.
I find lots of fly tying material there, really cheap.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
really good. Especially during this time of the year, like the holiday season, you can get tinsel and all sorts of great stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. Well, I've had a great time, and it's fun, Lyle, because it's I was focused so heavily this summer on Corvina. Now I'm finding like new species that I'm going, new places to go, new things to do. So I'm trying to diversify. I'm going to hit you up for a few more hints of some new places to go and where to try to find some new things. So
sure.
It's fun. Like it's a lot of fun.
It's a journey. It's a lifetime journey, Chris.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of it. You're never going to learn it all. And you can always explore new places. And when people ask me, hey, Al, why do you fish? Well, it's not about really the fish. A lot of times it's just about exploring and going to new places and meeting new people and being in pretty places. I mean, every time I'm down at the ocean, I'm happy. You know, I'm just happy.
I mean, it's really, that's what I was telling myself, especially when I wasn't catching fish, is like, it's still a great day. I mean, you got to be down at the ocean at sunrise.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
I know. You know, see the sun come up.
You see dolphins go by and, you know, it's just crazy. You know, birds everywhere. It's quite beautiful. It's in fact, when the people start showing up, it's not as fun.
That's right. That's right. I agree with that.
Yeah, it's absolutely great. Well, this has been such a cool chat, Al. I appreciate really a lot of it. I'm very excited about it. Tell people where they can follow you on Instagram, because I don't remember your Instagram.
My Instagram, I think, is Al Quattrocci. So if you just look up Al, A-L, and then Quattrocci is Quattrocci.
Which Quattro, I believe stands for...
Quattro Occhi.
Four eye.
Eyes.
Right, which is not glasses.
Not glasses. Uh-huh. I got two back here.
Okay.
I could see 360.
That's perfect. Well, thanks so much, Al. Appreciate it.
And this is coming out.
Oh, there it is. Corbina Diaries. That's the book that's coming
out. Corbina Diaries, yes. And and you can look, you can. There's a pre-sale at Love... L-O-V-E 2, the number 2, mm-hmm. Flyfish Media at bigcartel.com.
Okay, that's where it's going to be available. This podcast may come out after those pre-sales are probably going to be done. So people are going to be able to
buy it. But you can still get the books there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. So you can do that, which is great. But yeah, that's going to be really great. And beautiful photography, I know that. And listen... Fishing books are not necessarily very beautiful books, but if this is Al who made the book, it's going to be a really, really beautiful book. So I'm extremely excited to see, because I haven't seen the inside of this book. I haven't seen the inside of this book.
I can't wait for you to see it. And the one thing I did try to do with this book is I didn't want it to be like any other fly fishing book. So every page, every spread is different. You're going to just experience it. It's basically eye candy with some text. Okay.
Right. So it's going to be absolutely awesome. I'm very excited about this book coming out, and it really made my summer to be able to hang out with you, et cetera. You know, because otherwise this was going to be a really crappy summer if I didn't have that. But it was one of the best summers.
It was my pleasure to meet you, and it's been great. We've become good friends, and I'm so excited about you going off on this new journey, and me being a little part of it. And the fact that you and your son, I got to experience your son catch his first corbina, and you guys are in the book. So it means a lot to me. The whole experience means a lot to me.
Yeah. I'm really excited about that. I'm really excited. And Brady's excited about being in a book. He's like, I'm in a book? And I was like, yep.
Yeah. My daughter, too.
My
daughter Quinn's like, I can't believe you put me in the book. She goes, does that mean I'm a celebrity? I said, no, you're not a celebrity. I just took a picture of you. That's all. So it's all good. We fish together, you know, we're fun.
Great. She's great. She's such a sweet girl. Well, this is great. Thank you so much, Al. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate you having me on, and I hope to see you on the sand soon.